the 2000 election, and the war on terrorism. It was clear as Clinton ended his two-term presidency, the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution set two terms as a limit, that the Democratic candidate for president would now be the man who served him faithfully as vice president, Albert Gore. The Republican Party chose as its candidate for president the governor of Texas, George W. Bush, Jr., known for his connection to oil interests and the record number of executions of prisoners during his term in office. Although Bush, during the campaign, accused Gore of appealing to class warfare, the candidacy of Gore and his vice presidential candidate, Senator Joseph Lieberman, posed no threat to the super-rich. A front-page story in the New York Times was headlined, "As a Senator, Lieberman is proudly pro-business," and went on to give the details. Lieberman was loved by the Silicon Valley high-tech industry, and the military-industrial complex of Connecticut was grateful to him for their $7.5 billion in contracts for the Seawolf submarine. The degree of difference in the corporate support of the two presidential candidates can be measured by the $220 million raised by the Bush campaign and the $170 million raised by the Gore campaign. Neither Gore nor Bush had a plan for free national health care, for extensive low-cost housing, for dramatic changes in environmental controls. Both supported the death penalty and the growth of prisons. Both favored a large military establishment, the continued use of landmines, and the use of sanctions against the people of Cuba and Iraq. There was a third-party candidate, Ralph Nader, whose national reputation came from decades of persistent criticism of corporate control of the economy. His Green Party program was sharply different from the two major candidates, emphasizing health care, education, and the environment. But he was shut out of the nationally televised debates during the campaign. And without the support of big business, he had to raise money from the small contributions of people who believed in his program. It was predictable, given the unity of both major parties around class issues and the barriers put up against any third-party candidate, that half the country, mostly at lower income levels, and unenthusiastic about either major party, would not even vote. A journalist spoke to a cashier at a filling station, wife of a construction worker, who told him, "I don't think they think about people like us. Maybe if they lived in a two-bedroom trailer, it would be different." An African-American woman, a manager at McDonald's, who made slightly more than a minimum wage of $5.15 an hour, said about Bush and Gore, quote, "I don't even pay attention to those two, and all my friends say the same. My life won't change," unquote. It turned out to be the most bizarre election in the nation's history. Al Gore received hundreds of thousands of votes more than Bush, but the Constitution required that the victor be determined by the electors of each state. The electoral vote was so close that the outcome was going to be determined by the electors of the state of Florida. This difference between popular vote and electoral vote had happened twice before, in 1876 and 1888. The candidate with the most votes in Florida would get all that state's electors and win the presidency. But there was a raging dispute over whether Bush or Gore had received more votes in Florida. It seemed that many votes had not been counted, especially in districts where many black people lived, that ballots had been disqualified on technical grounds, that the marks made on the ballots by the voting machines were not clear. Bush had this advantage. His brother Jeb Bush was governor of Florida, and the Secretary of State in Florida, Catherine Harris, a Republican, had the power to certify who had more votes and had won the election. Facing claims of tainted ballots, Harris rushed through a partial recounting that left Bush ahead. An appeal to the Florida Supreme Court, which was dominated by Democrats, resulted in the court ordering Harris not to certify a winner and for recounting to continue. Harris set a deadline for recounting, and while there were still thousands of disputed ballots, she went ahead and certified that Bush was the winner by 537 votes. This was certainly the closest call in the history of presidential elections. With Gore ready to challenge the certification and ask that recounting continue, as the Florida Supreme Court had ruled, the Republican Party took the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court split along ideological lines. The five conservative judges, Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, Kennedy, O'Connor, despite the usual conservative position of non-interference with state powers, overruled the Florida Supreme Court and prohibited any more counting of ballots. They said the recounting violated the constitutional requirement for, quote, equal protection of the laws, unquote, because there were different standards in different counties of Florida for counting ballots. The four liberal judges, Stevens, Ginsburg, Breyer, Souter, argued that the court did not have the right to interfere with the Florida Supreme Court's interpretation of state law. Breyer and Souter argued that even if there was a failure to have a uniform standard in counting, the remedy was to let there be a new election in Florida with a uniform standard. The fact that the Supreme Court refused to allow any reconsideration of the election meant that it was determined to see that its favorite candidate, Bush, would be president. Justice Stevens pointed this out with some bitterness in his minority report. Quote, although we may never know with complete certainty the identity of the winner of this year's presidential election, the identity of the loser is perfectly clear. It is the nation's confidence in the judge as an impartial guardian of the rule of law. Unquote. Bush, taking office, proceeded to pursue his pro-big business agenda with total confidence, as if he had the overwhelming approval of the nation. And the Democratic Party, its fundamental philosophy not too different, became a timid opposition, going along completely with Bush on his foreign policy and differing from him only mildly on his domestic policy. Bush's program became immediately clear. He pushed tax cuts for the wealthy, opposed strict environmental regulations that would cost money for the business interests, and planned to privatize Social Security by having the retirement funds of citizens depend on the stock market. He moved to increase the military budget and to pursue the Star Wars program, though the consensus of scientific opinion was that anti-ballistic missiles in space could not work, and that even if the plan worked, it would only trigger a more furious arms race throughout the world.